Well, thank you very much, Dr. Sturgio. Fellow presenters, colleagues, it's a great pleasure to be here. Good morning to you all. Let me just tell you that I'm going to be talking about health reform in England, and particularly public health reform. I'll just explain a little bit about the differences in the four countries of the United Kingdom. Sometimes we act as one country in the UK, and on other occasions when it suits us, for example with football tournaments, we act as four separate countries. I believe this should be... Okay. So what I'm going to be covering today are the main proposals in the public health legislation in England, a little bit about the rationale behind them and the principles, some of the health challenges that we're facing that these proposals are designed to address. I thought perhaps the easiest way of doing this would be to carry out a SWOT analysis for those of you who are familiar with it, a strengths, weaknesses, opportunities and threats analysis of the proposed legislation, and I thought I would say a little bit about the reception that the draft legislation has received amongst professionals and the public in the UK. Now, it is important for me to say, particularly if there's anyone from Scotland, Wales or Northern Ireland here, that I am talking about England. We have lost Scotland, we've lost Wales, and over here, Northern Ireland. I am talking about England, and it's worth just saying that a little over three quarters of the population of the United Kingdom is in England. So these reforms are important. We now have devolved administrations in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. They are responsible for their own health legislation and they are following very different courses. And in fact, there is much for us to learn in England from what has been happening in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. Well, why is it important for us to have a new system? I think everybody has agreed that the challenges we're facing as we move through the next few decades are perhaps greater than they have been in combination for many, many, many years. We have all of the modern-day non-communicable disease and lifestyle issues that you've heard about already today. They're going to be with us for as far into the future as I can see. We also have re-emerging communicable diseases such as TB, particularly in the UK and in many other European countries, driven in part by migration between countries. We have emergency and disaster responses. You've all seen what's been happening to the weather in Pennsylvania and just to the north of Washington. Well, we have very similar challenges to health arising from climate change-driven changes to our weather in the United Kingdom as well. And, of course, we have emerging communicable diseases such as HIV, SARS, and pandemic flu. All of these are likely to conspire together to present the type of challenges to public health in the years to come that we've not really seen in the past, on top of which we have major demographic changes as well, an increase in the number of older citizens, a smaller proportion of people who are economically active, increasing migration within countries and between continents and different ethnic groups, and also a redistribution of skills across regional and national boundaries, which has caused us some complications within the United Kingdom. And today is a particularly auspicious day. If you have been listening to the news, you will know that the 31st of October 2011 is the day when we have hit 7 billion people on the planet. We have seen a 16.6% increase in the number of people on the planet in the last 10 years alone. And all of the challenges to public health that we face, to some extent, are driven by the fact that we have an overpopulated, overconsuming ecosystem. And that is one of the challenges that we will have to address in years to come. So health in the future is going to be very much a balancing act between economic growth and sustainable development, between healthcare provision and tackling the fundamental determinants of health, And between, for example, if we look at 4, energy demand versus environmental impact, and finally, improvements for the affluent at the expense of the worst off. These will all be challenges, a balancing act that we'll have to face. So we have to have a vision for the future, and here I turn to one of the illustrious presidents of the United States, who has provided me with more quotations than anybody else I can possibly think of, and it was George Bush who said, "I have a vision for the future as well as a vision of the past." And of course, the legislation in the United Kingdom, and particularly in England, is being driven by a particular vision for the future. So in England, we had 2 white papers, papers that set out what government intends to do. One in July last year, which looked at the healthcare system, and one in November, which looked at public health. They ran into a number of complications earlier this year, which resulted in the government putting a halt on the legislation to consult more widely with the professions and with the public. And we now have a revised health and social care bill going through Parliament as I speak. It's currently in the House of Lords, our upper chamber, and several of us, including Professor Lindsay Davis, who is sitting over there from the Faculty of Public Health, are involved in helping members of Parliament to draft amendments to the legislation to make it as fit for purpose as we possibly can. It is the largest health bill since the founding of the National Health Service in 1948. It is an enormous piece of legislation, very complex, but also with considerable aspirations. There are hopes that over the next 4 years, from 2012, it will save $30 million plus dollars by functioning more efficiently and effectively, and that those $30 million will be ploughed back into new areas for development in the healthcare system, but in particular in public health. One of the things that the government is trying to do at the moment is to also identify the total spend on public health, which is estimated in England as being between $6 and $7 billion per annum. But this is a hugely complex task. We're trying to calculate the cost of both national activity and all of the activity occurring locally. And the intention, as I said, is to reinvest those savings back into public health to a considerable extent. And the total spend on the National Health Service, that is a mistake actually, I said $105 billion, it is in fact £105 billion, which would be about $160 billion. That's the total spend in England on our National Health Service. So what are some of the objectives that government has in mind? Well, the first thing that they want to do is to move public health at the local level from the National Health Service into local government. Local government is managed separately from the healthcare system at the local level, but it is responsible for education, for planning, for social services, for transport, for a whole range of services which affect the social and economic determinants of health. They also want to see a more mixed economy of providers in healthcare and public health, so that the best provider, whether from the public sector, the voluntary sector, or the private sector, is the provider of choice, and the hope is that we will see a more effective and efficient system as a result of a more mixed economy. One of the other proposals is that commissioning of healthcare and public health should be led much more by primary care, by the primary care services, and in particular by our family doctors. They would like to see a greater third sector involvement, the not-for-profit sector, a stronger public voice and accountability at the local level to local people, and there is a clear aspiration to reduce inequalities in health. All of the figures that you saw from the first presenter in terms of inequalities in health, you could absolutely mirror that by taking a socio-demographic gradient across the United Kingdom. So what are some of the underpinning principles of the legislation that we're looking for? The government is seeking to empower local authorities, local government, to a much greater extent. They want to enable professionals much better to use their skills. They want to foster an environment of innovation and new ideas. They're arguing for a greater a concentration on evidence-based approaches. They want to increase the resilience of the public health system, particularly around health protection, which will be nationally led but locally delivered, whilst at the same time encouraging health improvement to be led locally and to be more responsive to the needs of local people. They are arguing for action on the wider determinants of health, with all social and economic sectors being involved. But the NHS, the National Health Service, will clearly still have a role in screening, in vaccination programs, and in long-term conditions. They have adopted a life course approach, so looking at where the investments at every single stage, from preconception through to old age, where those investments can take place, so that we reinforce impact at different stages of the life course. But having said that, the early years, 0 to 5 in particular, are seen by the government as being the priority. What about the national architecture? What are the changes we're going to see in the systems and the organisations? The Department of Health in England will remain responsible and will still be responsible for policy. However, we are going to have 3 national organisations overseeing all of the changes. An organisation called Public Health England, which will be responsible for overall strategy and for monitoring what happens at the local level. A national commissioning board, which will commission only those services that can only best be provided through a national approach. Most services will be commissioned at the local level, but there will be some specialised services which will require to be commissioned nationally. And we will also have a body called Health Education England, which will be responsible for all of the workforce supply, identifying how many people we need at which particular point in time to deliver which particular services. At the local level, the needs of the local population will be identified through a joint strategic needs analysis. That will feed into local commissioners, led by GPs, but including other primary care professionals as well, and they will form clinical commissioning groups. Every local authority will be required to have a health and wellbeing board, which will comprise a number of people from beyond the local authority who have a responsibility for and can contribute to the health and well-being of their local communities. But because not everybody can sit on these health and well-being boards, I think it is quite likely that we will see something like a partnership council or some other arrangement as well. There are 5 current streams of work going on nationally in England. The first is to properly identify the role of Public Health England. And if you look just below that, to look at that in the context of the role of local government. What are the relative responsibilities nationally and locally? I mentioned earlier that government is trying to identify the total amount of spend on public health and to capture that so it can be transferred with the transfer of local public health services. The government has placed considerable emphasis on having an outcomes framework. What are the specific health outcomes that we are looking for over the coming years? What should we be directing our resources to achieve at the national level, and which will provide guidance to people locally so that they can marry together those national outcomes and the local needs of local populations? And finally, a workforce strategy. If we don't have the right people with the right skills in the right place at the right time, all of the rest of this will be to no avail. So what are some of the strengths? I'm going to run through this very quickly in the interests of time and to keep the chairman's blood pressure low. Strong political commitment. I do not doubt the commitment of the politicians that we have. We probably have as strong a commitment to public health as I have ever seen. It will hopefully identify national and local roles, a greater involvement of local government, a participation by many sectors, emphasis on the social determinants of health, the intention to impact on all health-related goods, services and the environment. It recognises the fact that there are major resource issues here. The fact that it focuses on outcomes is very much a strength, but I'll say more about that in a moment or two. It does encourage professional leadership and community empowerment, and there has been a strong process, almost too much at times, consultation. Local accountability, public scrutiny, obviously we would all agree that those are desirable outcomes. And one of the things I've not mentioned yet, our health visitors, our public health nurses, there is a proposal to increase the number of health visitors by 50% over the next 4 years. There are weaknesses, though. It is only a framework. It will be open to local interpretation with all of the inconsistencies, particularly in relation to health improvement that that might bring. There could be that lack of or variable commitment, which could indeed increase inequalities in health. The strategy is not evidence-based, even though the proposal is that all of the programs, the interventions, should be. There is no regional structure, and yet we know that there are some elements of public health which would be better delivered at a regional level, not locally and not nationally. There is an overemphasis on individual action. Despite everything that has been said about tackling the social determinants of health, nevertheless, there is a strong focus on individuals taking responsibility for themselves, even though, of course, none of us lives or grows up in a vacuum. We're all the products of the society and the environment in which we live. There is a lack of clarity about lines of accountability. It is complex, and in my view, a personal view, it will actually add transition costs in making the move from where we are to where the government wants us to be, and my own personal view is it could well add transaction costs after the changes have occurred. But there are opportunities here. A new public health service, new opportunities. There is the potential to link academia to practice much better than has been the case in the past, to bring evidence to the table, better joint planning in terms of workforce supply. It does identify, or hopefully will, identify the resources required. There is the potential for more transparent and effective commissioning. It could focus more on social determinants of health, if there is a will to do so. And there is the potential to engage the business sector, but this must be in support of health and not having business distort the way health is delivered. The impact of the voluntary sector could be considerable, and we could end up with clearer priorities as a result. New approaches? Well, I certainly hope so, but at a time of major change, when people are concerned about that change, people may go for safe commissioning, commission what they've had in the past rather than what they should commission in the future. My own view is that every commissioning body should be required to keep 10% of its budget aside for new approaches and to be able to report on that on a yearly basis. We should have, if all goes well, better coordinated health protection nationally and locally. There could be a better balance between local initiatives and national action. There is the potential for additional local funding. We've also got a new chief medical officer in England who is bringing new ideas to the table. And we do have the potential here for evidence-based implementation approaches, even though the overall policy itself is not rooted in evidence. And just to pick out one or two of these things, we also have a much to be recommended a cabinet subcommittee on public health working across government. There are threats. The chaos that goes with any reorganisation. The time frame is too lengthy for many people working on the ground, people working in public health, but it's too fast to do all of this effectively, and that is a conundrum that we often have to face. There may well be inadequate commissioning expertise and indeed commissioning overlap between the various bodies that are responsible for commissioning different types of services. Perhaps most of all, because of all of the changes, we are seeing huge attrition in the public health workforce. These are people who not only have enormous expertise, but have faced too many reorganisations and do not want to face another one, but they're also the people who train the next generation of people as well. So we may well live with the consequences for quite a long time. I'm going to move through these fairly quickly. Individual responsibility and the emphasis on individuals can absolve the state from its responsibilities to tackle the fundamental determinants of health. I would argue that government, and no government in the United Kingdom, has ever used all of the policy instruments that are available to it to improve health. We have something called a responsibility deal, which in the main is a link between business and health, but there are strong suspicions that this and its actions are being distorted by the interests of business rather than the interests of health. So far, we've not engaged the third sector, the voluntary sector, as much as we should have done. And there is a problem, I think, potentially, with the monies that are being identified for public health being used for other purposes when they transfer to local government. And many people have said that even though there are opportunities here, it is the most risky venture for health care and public health since the health service was formed in 1948. I'm not going to run through all of these. I've mentioned a few of them. There are a number of dilemmas, the relative responsibilities of individual and the state, putting social determinants action into place, whether or not local politics will actually distort the evidence base. We all know that politicians look at evidence through a political filter and sometimes pick only the evidence that supports the political philosophy that they are already signed up to. So that is a danger as well. There is a problem of potentially devolution whilst at the same time monitoring and accountability by the centre. And I would also argue that outcomes without a clear idea of how we're going to get to those outcomes in terms of inputs, processes and intermediate outputs would be a mistake. When I mentioned all of the policy options, every government has at its disposal the opportunity to use legislative approaches, regulations, organisational change, public education, fiscal measures, a whole range of different approaches that in total could make a fundamental difference to health. And this is where it appears to have been frozen. I suspect this is the chairman's doing to ensure that I come to the end of my session on time. I can't unlock this. It seems to be absolutely frozen. I had a few more slides, but as we're now about 20 minutes since I started, I'm just going to conclude by saying that we really have got an opportunity here in the UK and elsewhere to use all of these potential approaches to improving health. Many of us, I think, understood that the evidence was telling us that we need to use all of these complementary approaches many years ago. I've just had a rather large birthday, and I've now been in public health for almost 35 years. I was then an angry young man in my 20s. Because we were not doing all that we could do in the interests of public health. I'm even more angry now, and the population ought to be even more angry now, because over the last 35 years we have squandered, we have lost so many of those opportunities to improve health and well-being. And it's not for me so much about whether we increase lifespan and longevity, it's more about whether we increase the quality of life and, from an economic point of view, the productivity of that workforce. There are economic gains as well as social and health gains to all of these programs. So as I reached my 60th birthday a couple of weeks ago and realized that I now no longer have anywhere near as much time to see all of these changes as I had 35 years ago, I am now even more angry than I was, and I hope all of you will be equally angry and follow the proposals and sign up to the arguments that my fellow presenters made earlier, and that hopefully the legislation in the United Kingdom is seeking to achieve. Thank you.